Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream. Do 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 shaboom. 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 Shaboom, if I could take you up in paradise up above. Shaboom, and tell me, darling, I'm the only one that you love. Life could be a dream. Sweetheart, hello, hello again. Shaboom, and hope for me again. Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream.
Hey, I want to welcome everybody at all of our campuses, people joining us online, but especially we want to welcome our brand new campus at South City. We love you. We are cheering you on. Last week was the launch weekend, and everybody ought to know the South City campus, we had over 430 people. They actually got a certificate from the county declaring November 12th Menlo Church Day. And we can't wait to see what God is going to do. You guys, way to go. Keep going. Now, I'll start with this question. When do you think children are first able to lie? The old answer was when they can talk. It turns out actually to be earlier than that. No kidding. There was a study done, Sacred Heart University in Tokyo. Babies who cannot even talk yet learn to cry when they are not distressed, just because it will fake their parents out into giving them the attention that they want. And when you fall for that, when you come and hug them, they are laughing at you in their little six-month-old psychopathic souls. Then, as soon as children learn how to use words, they are capable of lying, but they're actually pretty bad at it at first. Take a look at this video.
John, what are you eating?
Okay.
You didn't eat anything.
Yeah. Okay.
John, look at mommy.
Anything.
Are you telling me the truth?
That.
You didn't have any snacks?
Nope.
Let me see. You didn't have any snacks. Open wide, let me see. Really? You didn't have any snacks? John, can you explain to me why the sprinkles are empty?
Well, they're not empty.
John, look at me.
They're not empty.
Did you eat those sprinkles?
No, I did not.
Where do those little people learn how to lie? Well, they learn it from big people. The most famous study on deception in our day found that a majority of adults lie 2 to 3 times in a 10-minute conversation. Lying is found in every culture in the world. We lie about our motives. We lie about why we're late. We lie about what we really said. We cheat on our taxes or our expense accounts or our resumes. We lie to our spouses. We lie to our children. We lie to our bosses. We lie in the games that we play. What'd you get on that hole? Put me down for a 5. That's such an interesting language, isn't it? Put me down for a 5. I really got a 6, but that number makes me feel bad. I'd feel great about a 4, but that's too big a lie. Then I'd have to admit I was a big fat liar. So 5 will be a Goldilocks lie. Not too big, not too little, just right. This is the human condition. We want to speak the truth, but we're prepared to lie if we think it's necessary. Like the little Sunday school girl who said, a lie is an abomination unto the Lord and a very present help in time of trouble. We lie to get stuff, we lie to sell stuff, we lie to impress people, we lie to get out of trouble, we lie at church. By the way, we're giving away a free book this weekend. I'd like you more if you are more like me. One of the topics in the book is how to be authentic and to build true, honest, open intimacy. We're really glad to give it away. The only rule is only one book per household. If you take 2, that's a lie. God will know, you'll get in trouble. All over our culture, in politics, in the media, fake news, fact checkers, spin is such a problem that the Oxford Dictionary Word of the Year for 2016 is post-truth. One researcher said the number one finding in surveying people about lying is people lie about how much they lie. Now, God knows all about this. I was thinking this week, every lie we ever tell is as ridiculous to God as that little kid with the sprinkles all over his face saying that he never ate the sprinkles. Hey, Adam, what have you been eating? Nothing. It's the woman. It's the serpent. We're told very early in Jesus' ministry, but Jesus did not trust them because he knew all about people. No one needed to tell him about human nature, for he knew what was in each person's heart. In other words, you can fool some of the people all the time, you can fool all the people some of the time, you can never fool Jesus. Anytime anybody lies, we look to God like that kid with the sprinkles. Now, Jesus talks about our words and truth-telling in the Sermon on the Mount. Very interesting. When he talked about anger, he began with the Ten Commandments, you shall not murder. Same thing with sexuality, you shall not commit adultery. So we'd expect with truth-telling, he'd go back again to the Ten Commandments, you shall not bear false witness. But he doesn't. He begins actually in such a different place that this is really the least talked about teaching in the whole Sermon on the Mount. Here's what he said. Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, and do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair black or white. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond that is from the evil one. Now we read those words and wonder, why in the world does Jesus care about people swearing by heaven? You might be thinking, I never swear by heaven or earth or Jerusalem or my head, so I'm doing great on this teaching. Sometimes people have taken Jesus' teaching in this part of the Sermon on the Mount kind of mechanically or literalistically as a rule against ever taking an oath. And so they will not go into the military or testify in court or do anything that requires oath taking. But that is not Jesus' concern. Remember, he is showing us in this part of the Sermon on the Mount what true inner goodness, surpassing righteousness, looks like, and contrasting that with conventional interpretation or wisdom about goodness and the law back in Israel's day. So, to understand his concern here, let's go back to little kids again. We all lie. Little kids lie. So, what do I do when I have to make sure you believe me? Because if you don't believe me, I might not get you to do what I want you to do, and I got to get you to do what I want you to do. So, little kids invented something called a promise. I promise I'm telling you the truth this time. And then we'll add variations to convince others of our sincerity. Cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. You have to believe me now, because if you don't, I'll be dead in a coffin with a needle in my eye, and it'll be your fault for not believing me. Every culture has lying. That's why every culture has oaths or promises. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in his teaching on the Sermon on the Mount, said, oaths give evidence to lying. Now, an oath generally invoked something sacred. In the ancient world, may the gods deal with me severely if I am not telling you the truth. Today, even now, we'll hear people say something like, I swear by my mother's grave, or I swear by all that's holy, or I swear on a stack of Bibles. So, oaths were around in the ancient world. Israel was taught to make oaths in the name of the one true God. This is from Deuteronomy. Fear the Lord your God, serve him only, and take your oaths in his name. Often they would acknowledge God's presence with their body by raising their hand. This is from the Old Testament. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, with raised hand I have sworn an oath to the Lord God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. Even to this day, if you go into a courtroom, you will often be asked to put your hand on a Bible, raise your right hand, and solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God. Now, in Jesus' day, a devout Jewish person would often refrain from using the name of God as a sign of devotion. Don't want to misuse that sacred name. So they would substitute and make their oath by heaven or by Jerusalem. But it's the same idea. Okay, that's the backdrop. Jesus goes to the heart of the problem with the oath system. And the problem is, we don't tell the truth. Lots of times, we don't tell the truth. And then we end up using pressure or guilt or a song and dance to impress other people with our sincerity and get them to do what we want. I promise, I promise, I promise. Two of our kids were in the back seat when they were quite little. There was a slapping sound, and the little one started crying. The older one knew she was in trouble, so she promised that she was not the slapper. And I'm thinking, what am I supposed to believe here, that the baby slapped herself? The older one got so worked up defending her innocence, she got tears in her eyes and said in a trembling voice, "Daddy, you don't think I'd lie to you, do you?" And I started to feel so guilty. How could I think that? And then I realized what was going on. I said, "Yes, I do. Mostly you're telling the truth, but you could be a little liar." And Nancy said, "Oh man, she's been getting me with that one forever. I'm so glad you said that." And I said to Nancy, "Well, don't be so happy. You can be a little liar too." And Nancy said, "Well, you lie worse than me." And we had a real good conversation. Now, Jesus understood the reason that we use oaths, I swear, I promise, it's the gospel truth, is that we are desperate to get the other person to believe what I want them to believe so that they will do what I want them to do. And therefore, instead of simply saying, "Here's the information, you have the freedom to decide," instead of that, I want to pressure you, I want to manipulate you, I want to try to override your judgment or your will in order to get what I want out of you. So, swearing an oath in this passage is just one example of what in our day is sometimes called a song and dance, or being a spin doctor, going into the spin room. Now, the Old Testament condemned lying by the use of oaths. They treated oaths, which was around in the ancient world, kind of like training wheels for truth-telling. You know, swear by the one true God. But people would turn that into legalism and say, well, as long as you keep your oath, then you're righteous. And now that the kingdom of God has come in a unique, fresh, powerful way through Jesus, it's time to take the training wheels off. Love means I honor your will because that's the core of your personhood. So I don't try to pressure you. I don't deceive you. I don't manipulate you. Just simply, yes, it's like this. Nope, it's like that. I honor your capacity to decide because I love you more than I want to get my way, because I've abandoned my way, my will now, to God's kingdom, God's will, your kingdom come. I'm living in the freedom of his kingdom and will. See, you can tell somebody the truth without loving them, but you cannot love somebody without telling them the truth. Kingdom righteousness, surpassing goodness, respects the sole need of human beings to make their judgments and decisions solely from what they have concluded is best, Dallas Willard wrote. I read recently somebody who said that the secret to truth-telling is to pre-decide ahead of time, to determine to tell the truth no matter what. But actually, that's not the secret. The secret lies far deeper than that, and we'll come to the secret. So I want to spend the rest of this message looking at how that played out in an actual character in the Bible. And by the way, if you're feeling any guilt or shame on this subject, you might actually be encouraged to know that the Bible is full of liars. Adam, Eve, Cain, Abraham, Sarah, Moses, Aaron, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, Rachel, David, Samson, Herod, Ananias, and Sapphira, all over the Bible. But maybe the most spectacular lie in the Bible, like the Mount Everest of lies, came from the man that Jesus said he was going to build his church on. The night before Jesus died, he warned the disciples they would all disown him. We're told in the text, Peter replied, "Even if all fall away on account of you, I never will." Jesus pushed it back. You know, this very night, before the rooster crows, Peter will deny him three times. But Peter declared, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." Now, do you think Peter was sincere when he said that? I sure do. I think in that moment, he was deeply stirred emotionally. I'll bet you he had tears in his eyes as he pictured himself being a martyr for Jesus, because we get that way. We're so convinced of our sincerity. He predetermined he would tell the truth no matter what. Let's see how well that works. A few hours later, Jesus is on trial to be crucified. Peter is sitting in the courtyard. He is as close to Jesus as he dares to get. Servant girl sees him and claims that Peter had been with Jesus. But he denied it before them all. I don't know what you're talking about. Notice, he doesn't say, I never followed Jesus. The lie isn't that blunt. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe he convinces himself that's true. I'm not really sure what she's saying. See, if you get good at lying, you rationalize it in the act. You can actually get offended when somebody accuses you of lying, even though deep down inside you are lying. Now, how did Peter go from, I'm ready to die, to I'm ready to lie? Well, see, the only foundation for truth-telling is that I die to myself so that I can live in the care and safety of God, and I trust Him to watch out for me no matter what happens. If I believe I have to watch out for myself, I will keep lie as a tool that might be necessary. Only if I trust there is a greater reality, the kingdom of God, can I let that go. And I'd invite you this week, just start in real small things. This is so small, it's quite embarrassing, but it's my life. I mentioned golf earlier. I was playing not long ago, playing with my dad, playing very badly, and the numbers on the card were making me feel badly about myself. And then I remembered the basic prayer of life in Jesus' kingdom, thy will be done. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth. And I literally started praying that prayer with every shot. I know it sounds goofy, but that's where I live. I kid you not. At one point, I was hitting over a water hazard very early in the round, and I hit a ball over the water, and I just prayed, thy will be done. I hit a second ball into the water. Thy will be done. I hit a third ball in a row in the water. Really, God, that's your real? Seriously? I know it's trivial. Why would I be attached to a number at a game I'm not even good at? But here's the thing about sin. Sin is trivial. Sin is mostly about immensely trivial desires. Our emotions get attached to embarrassingly trivial achievements or appearances or getting our way about stuff we know doesn't matter. And to be on a golf course and to say, I can get an octuple bogey and Jesus still loves me. I don't have to live in shame and hiding in deceit. I can die to myself. I can die to my score. And there's actually freedom and grace in the kingdom. Oh God, your kingdom come. See, it's in all the moments that we're tempted to deceive that I discover where I have not yet died to myself. And death to self, not predetermination, is the only foundation for truth. Well, this is what Peter is learning. And he lies, and there's this encounter. We're told, then he went out into the gateway where another servant girl saw him and said to the people there, this fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth. So interesting. Now Peter's body reflects what's happening in his soul. He leaves the courtyard to go outside to get farther away from Jesus because he knows if he's too close, he's likely going to have to answer the question. So he wants to get his body farther away. There's all kinds of research on how our bodies tend to betray our lies. When people lie, they tend to cover their mouth. They might cough. They might cover up their core. They might look in a different direction. Did you notice in the video when the kid was lying to his mom, he did not want to look her in the eyes. Look at me. Doesn't want to do that. Lying fractures, disintegrates the soul, our homeless. Peter denied it again with an oath. I don't know the man. He couldn't get them to believe him the first time, and he's got to get them to believe him because otherwise he might be in trouble. Otherwise he might die. So this time he takes an oath. I promise, cross my heart. Now we don't know what form the oath took. By heaven maybe, by Jerusalem. Maybe as God is my witness, cross my heart, hope to die. This time, the lie is more direct. This time it's not, I don't know what you're talking about. This time it's, I don't know the man. And lying works that way. It's easier to go further the second time. It's so striking. Even here, Peter cannot bring himself to say the name Jesus. I don't know the man. As if he's not even sure of the man's name. See, when I sin against you, I will avoid saying your name because I do not want to think of you as a person with your own kingdom. The deceptive soul is always a divided soul. Back to the text. After a little while, those standing there went up to Peter and said, "Surely you are one of them. Your accent gives you away." Peter, like Jesus, was from Galilee. And people from Galilee, which was in the north, had an accent. Accents are often associated with different status levels. A hillbilly accent is low. Any speaker with a British accent automatically gets 15 bonus IQ points. Did you ever notice that? The highest status accent in our day is a Swedish accent. Yeah, sure, you betcha. That's why Nobel Prizes come from Sweden. Now, to natives of big city Jerusalem, Galileans were hicks. They were rednecks. Your accent gives you away. You're a hillbilly like him. The noose is tightening. Peter is a cornered rat. Then Peter began to call down curses and swore to them, "I don't know the man." Who's he cursing? Maybe himself. "May God strike me dead if I'm not telling the truth." And he knows he's not telling the truth. So what does that say about his faith in God? Or maybe it's, "God curse you. God damn you. What's the matter with you? Why won't you believe me? Why don't you leave me alone? I swear on all that's sacred. I promise on a stack of Bibles. Don't know him. Don't love him. Didn't follow him. Won't die for him." This is hard to believe, but the grammar of the passage suggests that Peter is actually cursing Jesus. "God curse him. God strike him. I don't know him." See, Peter has one God now, his own skin. When we lie, we don't become atheists. We just change altars. And then a rooster crows. And then Peter remembers the word that Jesus had spoken. "Before a rooster crows, you will disown me three times." And then this very devastating line, "And he went outside and wept bitterly." And now he's as far away from Jesus outside as he can get. Lying will do that. "This is my soul. This is my devotion. I'm the one that was going to die for him." And maybe he remembered so long ago when he heard his teacher saying, "You have heard it said, do not break your oath. But I say to you, do not swear an oath at all. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one." And he is a broken, sobbing wreck. But that's not the end. And I have to tell you something just amazing. There is something revolutionary, otherworldly going on in this story. This is so beautiful. There's a classicist scholar. His name is Eric Auerbach. And he wrote that this story of Peter and his tears could not have been found in other ancient literature in the ancient world. Peter is not a king. He's not a soldier. He was not a subject that would have been considered worthy of a well-bred person's sympathy in the ancient world. This is what Auerbach writes. It's so amazing. "This little story is something which neither the poets nor the historians of antiquity ever set out to portray. The birth of a spiritual movement in the depths of the common people. A scene like Peter's denial fits no antique genre. It is too serious for comedy, too contemporary and everyday for tragedy, politically too insignificant for history. So what is it? What is it? It is this strange new world where the tears of a backwoods fisherman are the occasion for the inbreaking of the kingdom of God that leaves Pontius Pilate and Herod the Great as bit players on the ash heap of history. It is the Beatitudes come to life. Blessed are those that mourn. It's the upside down kingdom in an inside out world. Peter learns to live in grace." There's a tradition that for the rest of his life, if Peter was speaking and somebody in the crowd wanted to embarrass him, they would crow like a rooster. But it was precisely in his greatest failure that he received the greatest grace. So after Jesus was crucified, when the women go to Jesus' tomb, And an angel told them that Jesus had risen. This is what the angel says. Go tell the disciples and Peter. Why did the angel say, go tell the disciples and Peter? Hey, Peter, you big fat liar. You are not done. There's enough grace in the cross for you. See, Jesus promises that when we live in the freedom of death to self, in the power of the forgiveness of the cross, we receive a new strength that we could never generate on our own. And then all of a sudden, we're not living in our own power. It's so amazing. On the golf course, when I started praying, thy will be done, I started golfing better. I ended up shooting a 78, 92. Anyway, it's so interesting that it was Peter who would write, therefore, rid yourselves of all deceit. So, gang, this week, ask God to help you grow in love so that you actually want to honor other people's kingdoms. You want them to be free. So you give no song and dance this week, no spin, no pressure, no manipulation, no, you got to believe me so I get what I want out of you. Just let it be yes and no. Trust God, speak the truth, die to self, be free. Living in the truth really works. Cross my heart.